Hello. Thank you for tuning in to YQR Real Talk, RPL Film Theater's monthly podcast series. My name is Blair Fornwald, and I'm RPL Film Theater and Dunlop Art Gallery's curator of moving image and performance. Today, I'm joined by prolific experimental filmmaker and professor Gerald Saul to discuss Gerald's upcoming lecture and screening series, Dreaming of Surrealism, part of RPL Film Theater's film school programming stream. Welcome, Gerald. Thanks for coming.
Oh, thanks for having me in.
Do you want to give yourself a bit of an introduction?
Well, that was a nice introduction. I'm never a believer in long introductions. I don't know what that says about people. It says about me that I think what I want to say and what I have to talk about is more important than finding out that I, you know, have been a Regina-based filmmaker since the 80s and a longtime film pool member and associate professor at the University of Regina film program since 1999. And, you know, love movies.
Yeah. Yeah, you're a prolific movie maker and movie watcher.
Yeah.
Correct?
That would be it. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. I think that's a good introduction. So film school, for those who don't know, is a series where we've invited filmmakers, theorists, and academics to present a lecture and a screening on a topic of their choice. We started with your colleague Gordon Pepper's series, which was on the work of Alfred Hitchcock and auteur theory, focusing kind of on stylistic and thematic elements in his work. And now we're moving on with your presentation series, which instead is focusing on an artistic and cinematic movement, surrealism, thematically linking three films by three different filmmakers. And I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about your chosen films and the ideas that kind of guided your selections.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let me answer that question with a long and convoluted anecdote from my own life. A couple of years ago, I was involved in a project called the Caligari Project, and we were investigating German Expressionism, and it was a really successful project and it exhausted us. And we'd really wanted to do a follow-up to it, and we haven't begun that, and I don't even know if it'll happen, but the top of the list was surrealism, of a new theme to go after. It's the sort of theme that a lot of people think they understand, a lot of people are gravitated to, they're interested in the images, even though maybe they can only name a couple images, you know, Salvador Dali's Melting Clocks, whatever that painting is called.
Right, the ones that go on screensavers or...
Yeah,
or
those sorts of things.
Mouse pads.
You get a tire, yeah, mouse pad. But people kind of understand this idea of surrealism as these dreamlike, crazy things that are, zany, and they don't really know that much about them. So the common perception of surrealism is a bit watered down, and quite inaccurate. I guess I also want to jump back to the idea of the film school program. And I guess we debated this a bit at one of our meetings at the university, where we consider ourselves the film school in a way, and we're thinking, well, what does this mean? What does this film school mean that the library's doing?
Oh.
Well, and is anybody stepping on anybody's toes? And we won't, you know. But then I really got thinking, because when I learned filmmaking and when I was in school originally, the program was different. I went to the same program I'm teaching in now, but the area of film studies was different then. So it wasn't until my last couple of classes and grad school did I learn film studies in the way that the students learn film studies now, which is a very serious way of looking at film studies. It's analyzing, it's getting into the philosophical, theoretical, groundbreaking ideas, the very difficult deconstruction of these images to understand something completely different than what's on screen and all the underlying things. And it's a great exercise to do. It's a great experience to start understanding films in this other way. But at the same time, it also distances a viewer at times from the films.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
So, while it's very important to be able to do this for many people, especially filmmakers, but many people enjoy this process, there's also something to be said for what I guess I learned from some of the earlier film studies professors was more of a film appreciation, where you watch things that these professors think is worthwhile, and you get some insights They tell you what they think is an insightful thing about it. They talk about what's interesting to filmmakers about this, the compositions, the way the story unfolds, simpler things. The things that maybe a novice coming in off the street can say, I watch lots of movies because everybody mm-hmm. watches lots of movies. But to come in off the streets and say, I've never heard of this or I don't understand what this is, I know what the Avengers can do and I know how their stories unfold. And that's pretty complicated, but it's not. It's, you know, Avengers is pretty simple to understand. Mm-hmm. You know, there's good guys and there's bad guys and there's certain outcomes that are inevitable.
It's hard for me because I don't tend to have a very good mind for plot,
mm-hmm.
you know, or keeping track of a lot of characters.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so maybe Avengers isn't a great example, but no. it's really just like, you know, five examples on top yeah. of each other because you got lots of characters and lots of things happening. And it's, you know, it's a bit of a soap opera. It's a bit of all of these things.
It's a traditional narrative, I guess.
It is very traditional. And I like traditional narratives. I like watching an Avengers movie. I like having some fun just, you know, seeing things blow up. And you know, the spectacle. The spectacle is great. But I also appreciate other films. And when I recommend other films, let's say the examples of these three films, if I was just recommend them to somebody out of the blue, they might be confused by them. They might be, and confusion is a very negative emotion quite often. So if somebody finds themselves confused, then they have a bad experience. And these are not bad films. These are magical films. They're amazing. And there's just certain things that maybe need to be pointed out before you watch them to help you simply appreciate them, understand them just enough to enjoy them, because the filmmakers want you to enjoy them.
Oh, yeah. They're actually all quite quite funny, quite engaging. Two of them are pretty adventurous, you mm-hmm. know?
Oh, yeah.
Maybe all of them.
I want to quiz you on which one do you think is not adventurous?
Well, I guess they're all. I appreciate all of these films. I would say that Buñuel's Phantom of Liberty, it kind of washes over me in a way that like Hodorowski's Holy Mountain and The City of Lost Children do not.
Right.
They feel a bit more arresting.
Yes, yes. Well, okay, so let's backtrack. So this is just a whole bunch of thinking that goes into before I even picked out films. Mm-hmm. So again, a couple years ago, I started compiling a list of films that I saw as surrealist films. But they're not necessarily officially surrealist films, because the surrealist movement was a very well-defined, rigid movement that came out of the 1920s, 30s.
Manifestos.
And they had manifestos, and there was this the capital S surrealists. And I credit Rob Hillstead with getting me thinking about some of this. Rob is a filmmaker, and he was here doing a graduate degree a couple or 4 or 5 years ago. And he got a bee in his bonnet about surrealism. And he saw some listing for a sitcom that described itself as surrealist. Because it had one strange moment in the middle of the film, you know, one dream moment or something. And of course, it's not what surrealism was about at all. They were very much into Freudian psychology and kind of destroying the predictable nature of most art forms.
Yeah, it was a revolutionary movement, right?
Like, yes, yes.
And a very politically motivated, like...
Yes.
Movement in between the two wars, right? So yeah. It was a time when it seems like the world was really absurd.
Yeah, you can say that. Yeah, sure. It was an absurd world, and I'd love to be back there rubbing elbows with these guys and the sort of the ideas that flew out of it, because they all had, you know, crazy ideas. They really wanted to do interesting work, and it was brought together through this manifesto. But it didn't last forever. They each found different paths. And they were kind of dropped from the official register of surrealists, and no new surrealists were added. So today there are no official capital S surrealists. You know, they've all got cut off the list or died. The only one I'm screening tonight would have been Louis Bunuel, who was part of that circle of surrealists at the time.
Right.
But this is a work done 30 years later. And he had gone other directions, and he had lost the... Oh, what's the word I'm looking for? He had since been stricken off of that list because he'd gone other directions.
Did they kick him out?
Yeah. Breton, he kept a list. And right. He was strict about this thing. And if you deviated from what he saw as a surrealist, you were just taken off the list. So they don't exist anymore. But there are many filmmakers working within surrealist traditions in some way, either one way or another. So, again, when I started thinking about what would be a list of surrealist films, if we were to hold a screening, a year-long festival or something, I started making note of some of them. They're not just films that have a dreamlike moment. Even something like Spellbound by Hitchcock, which has a Salvador Dali scene in it, is rather corny, and it's rationalized very, very clearly. So I'm not sure why Dali agreed to do it. He must have had some fun. He had a
Didn't he do like Alka-Seltzer commercials? Like,
sure.
I think Dali's got to pay the bills.
Yeah. I doubt he had too much trouble paying the bills, but he did it for whatever reasons he did, but it's never considered to be a surrealist film, even though it's got Dali's hand, behind these particular scenes in it.
It's a film with a surrealist moment.
It's a
dream sequence.
It's a film with a dream sequence in it made by a surrealist.
Okay.
But it's clearly a dream sequence. And so we know, watching it, we know that's a dream. And it doesn't make very much sense, but we know that dreams don't make sense. And so we say, oh, that's a dream. It's crazy, and it does make sense, so there it is.
Yeah, here's reality, here's dreams.
Right, and when you can define that, then you're not in surrealism.
No, like that's exactly what André Breton was talking about, right? Where he was like, this is going to be a movement that's going to synthesize reality and dreams into some sort of super reality, and this is going to destroy capitalism and the world as we know it and social mores, and like that's fairly ambitious.
That's ambitious and and probably unrealistic, but it's good to turn certain people's lives around, certain ways of thinking around. So to me, the surrealist film is true to itself. Even if it doesn't fulfill everything Breton wanted it to do, it's true to itself. It doesn't explain itself. Like Spellbound, that explains itself. It says, this is a dream. Here we are. Here's the little musical cue saying we're going into a dream. Here's the dream. Now we come out of the dream. We're back to the regular drama. So everybody watching knows what's going on. Even if they don't understand the dream, they understand that that's what it is.
But that we're back to reality now. And we're back to a world that's not terribly unlike our own.
Yeah. But the three films I have all exist in their own worlds that play by their own rules, but they don't explain those rules to us. Maybe I'll start at the end. City of Lost Children is probably the lightest of the three films. It's a bit weird, but I think it could even be G-rated, at least PG-rated. I think a whole family could come watch this. It's got fun moments. It's got weird events. But it exists in a world that is not explained. Is it post-apocalyptic? Like there's weird machines. There's weird technology. There are people doing things that are socializing in a way that we don't quite understand. And it doesn't explain it. So if we watch Mad Max... And maybe there's a bit of a look that's similar. Yeah. If we watch Mad Max, it will say at the beginning, it's the year 2065, the war, blah, 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 the oil, blah, blah, blah. And now there's, only one protector, the road warrior. And here we go.
That's
and
amazing.
He drives around and does his thing. My cold allows me to do that narration voice.
I was just thinking that. Yeah, it's an extra timber in that.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's true, right? You don't kind of get a lot of backstory. You're just...
No, it just pulls us into this world. So we enter into the film, and it doesn't explain how the society works. We don't understand who's ruling it. We don't understand why these children are stealing things or how the economics work or how the science works. But, everything is different. And I compare it to a dream. Not a specific dream, but I will I don't remember my dreams very well, but I wake up from a dream and I might remember having been at an old workplace or an old school or something like that. And, you know, you're in the dream and you're at a, let's say a school. You remember you're at the school and you're trying to do something and something's trying to happen. And the whole building is different, but you don't think about that. You just accept it as
you know
that
it's school.
You know it's the school or you know it's your workplace or whatever it is. So you don't question things. You just live within this world knowing the answers. Nobody explains them to you. You don't explain them to yourselves. You don't question it. Nobody says, why are the doorways different? Why is everything a different color?
Because that's dreams.
That's dreams. So that's the sort of world that City of Lost Children is in. It's in a dream, maybe, and it's about dreams and it's about nightmares and it's about this manipulation of all of these things. Nobody ever stops and says, why is any of this like it is? It just accepts it. And when you go in to watch the film, if you just sit down and say, a world's going to come at me and it's not going to be explained, I'm just going to enjoy my experience of being in that world, then you will enjoy the film.
Yeah, and I think then you'll also find, like, of the three films you've chosen, it has the most coherent narrative.
Yes.
Although, yeah, it kind of takes place in this very, like, M.C. Escher kind of landscape. Like, I think the thing that really struck me is, like, it's like a dream space.
Yes.
Like, the architecture and the set that they're... the world that they're inhabiting doesn't seem to have the same sort of linearity or, like, horizon that ours does.
No, and it's isolated. You don't know how you get in and out. And nobody asks.
I can't tell if they're inside or outside a lot of the time.
Yeah. Yeah, and if you accept that you don't understand, if you can say, I am not going to be... if you can accept that no one is going to explain things to you, and you can just watch the story unfold as if you're experiencing a dream, you will enjoy that film a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Just let it come at you and watch it and enjoy it for what it is. And it's tremendous fun. If you insist on analyzing it and trying to understand it, you're going to be frustrated because it's not going to give you that.
Right.
So the rationalists will have a frustrating time with it, but if you can let go of the irrationality, you can have great pleasure with that film.
Yeah, I agree. And I think maybe same thing with The Phantom of Liberty.
Yes.
It's a really interesting kind of break in how a traditional narrative unfolds.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember reading in the liner notes there about what was it? Benoit was saying, "Oh, I would have enjoyed Crime and Punishment better if when the protagonist passes this little boy like who's going to the shop to buy a loaf of bread. If instead they just started following him and told his story."
Yes, yes. And the liner notes or something else I read about this film set me up for it. That in a way that helped me because I'm not sure when the first time I saw it I saw it many years ago and I'm sure was utterly confused and I went online to prepare for this talk. I thought, let's see what other people say about this, and I hit a couple of bloggers writing or talking about this film, and they were enraged by this film. They hated it.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, what? You know, what do they have to say? And there was no real good explanation except that they just thought it was a mess. They thought it was...
they wanted one protagonist.
Yeah, they thought it was incompetent in a way. That the story didn't follow, you know, a correct trajectory and was just confusing. And again, people don't like to be confused. You want to be on top of things. You want to be a step ahead of the filmmakers, which is ridiculous. Why should, if you're a step ahead of every filmmaker, why are you watching these movies? You know, I can predict what happens at the end of most movies. It's still sort of fun, but
not really at the end of a Benoit film, though.
No, you know. So sometimes it's nice. You're getting what you expected, but in a Benoit film, especially this one, what he's doing is he's frustrating you in a way that is very funny. When I was reading his autobiography or biography or something years ago, one thing that stuck with me was he had written an outline of every Hollywood story, and there were six of them or something. And he said, this is the six outlines that every Hollywood narrative follows. And then it points out that this list is missing. And so it doesn't exist for us to, but I could probably dream it up myself. But I didn't believe it at the time. I was much younger. But he used it with his Hollywood producers that he knew to prove to them that they were doing very, very predictable films. So what he does in this film is he builds a story up in a straightforward traditional way where you have a protagonist enters a scene, there a problem is addressed and proposed and put in front of us, and characters begin trying to figure out how to solve this problem, and the interest and the tension rises, and then we go off in another direction just when it's hitting its peak.
Yeah.
So
we, it keeps thwarting that expectation.
Yes. And when you realize that, going into it, that you're only going to have the rug pulled out from beneath you, it's almost like an intellectual slapstick comedy.
Yeah, I mean, without any disrespect, I was watching it and I was kind of like, it's kind of like the highest form of like sketch comedy or something. And so I'm wondering if these same people that like got enraged, basically this is a technique that like Monty Python used too, right?
Monty Python was one of the only ones that would ever have done it on wide scale TV,
like in a mainstream way. And I wonder if people sometimes just get their backs up because the Benoit has this sort of art house cachet, right? That they're like, oh, this is a French film and it's an old film and it's going to be bewildering. But I think if you just kind of approached it the same way you watched like Kids in the Hall or Monty Python or something, you might.
Yeah.
Find it more funny and less alienating.
Yes, and those are great comparisons. I laughed and laughed and laughed. I could barely stop laughing in that whole film because these ridiculous situations would come up that, you know, and you're waiting. Well, just solve it. Just turn around. The missing person is right there, or whatever it might be. And these absurd situations, but just as you're getting really engaged, you think, okay, now they're going to unfold it. Now they're going to figure it out.
No.
Nope. And then a new character walks in and you follow someone else through a door and you move on.
And you're kind of wondering, like, what's happening with that guy's aunt, or what happened after the dinner party, or, you know, what about that little girl that got the pornographic pictures, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And so it's a very, very funny film, and I think it just needs more attention. It's not one of his most seen films.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm not showing things like
Shannon DeLue. Thank you so much.
Shannon DeLue.
Thank you for not doing that.
Love the film, but it's it's old and
it's short.
It's shorter. It's a little bit too long, actually.
Really?
I think so. It was always surprises me how long it is.
You've seen it probably many times.
Many times.
Because teaching film.
And yeah, you put it up on screen once in a while, and usually you show the first 5 minutes, but it's 15 or 20 minutes long.
Yeah.
And a lot of people have seen it, and I don't think it's going to be a draw to the theater.
Yeah, it's very infamous.
Infamous, yeah.
Yeah.
And I wanted to bring things to the theater that people haven't seen as much of, that are known, that are not, completely obscure films, but that are lesser seen, that aren't up on Netflix.
Let's can we turn it over to Jodorowsky
and his we could try
The Holy Mountain. I think it would be very difficult to summarize that film.
I can't really do it, but again, he's just someone who has images in his head, and it's almost, as a filmmaker, I can kind of see those wheels turning, where each scene is to bring us to the next scene. That he's got some image in mind that he's going, I have to get this image on screen. Let's try to connect the dots and get there.
Right. Like the story that kind of holds everything together is actually fairly simple, right? Like it's kind of a hero's journey of enlightenment, but then there's all of these digressionary, like super interesting.
Yeah, you're not watching it for the hero's journey.
No, the hero's journey is actually not so great, I might argue.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
It's quite heavy-handed at times.
I don't know how to describe Holy Mountain.
It's very beautiful.
It is.
It's like, I think the thing that I really appreciate it, and it is, it's like maybe one of my favorite films, is this level of craft and detail that kind of goes into every aspect of its production. And I think it's also clearly made like on quite a low budget in Mexico in the 70s, but it's like, wow, you cast thousands of paper mache Jesuses. You made tiny Aztec regalia for iguanas.
The Aztec war. You know, the Spaniards and the Aztecs fighting with iguanas and
toads. And really toads. Horrible looking toads.
It was if it was made today, if Hollywood was to remake this, it would be a huge digital scene.
It would have to be.
It would be like some sort of Lord of the Rings scene, which would be strange, and toads would have their tongues shooting out and swallowing other beings and stuff. But he didn't have effects. He had passionate people with time.
And time and toads. And iguanas. And it was the 70s, so you didn't have to be kind to animals on film.
No.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah. Sure.
So
horrible things happen, but horrible things happen in wars.
And horrible things happen in real life.
Yeah.
Wars being part of real life.
They are there, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a very profoundly affecting film.
Mm-hmm. I think if he had made it very safe, if he had had no toads or iguanas die in these scenes, it wouldn't have meant anything. But, you know, that we are shocked by death of an iguana or death of a toad, well then, you know, weren't the real people who died, you know, isn't that more shocking? And shouldn't we be thinking about the wars? And but as a filmmaker, and I guess back to the film school aspect of this, when I look at these films, I think this is what someone with vision can do. It's not about the money. It's just about, can you convince 100 people to make, you know, to craft you some amazing objects? And can your passion and creativity be that contagious? Because it needed to be. The films are way too big for him as one individual, as creative as he was, for one individual to make. He needed
the set deck.
100 people to build these little things.
Those robots. Like, there's beautiful, like, animatronic robot sculptures and statues. Like, it feels more like installation art sometimes than it does sort of strictly a set.
Yeah. So I pulled out Holy Mountain, which I hadn't seen since some obscure time in the 80s, because of Jodorowsky's Dune, which is available.
Oh, right.
So that film is available on maybe Netflix or something like that. And it shows how Jodorowsky drew all of these tremendous creative people together to try to make a version of Dune back in the 1970s, considered to be the greatest film never made. That he found Salvador Dali and got Salvador Dali to agree to be in it, and all of these other
movies. H.R. Geiger involved, I think?
I think so, yeah. Geiger, you know, before Aliens.
Yeah.
And all the big special effects people that went on to do Star Wars and all the other big science fiction films, they were all signed on to work with Jodorowsky back before that. And, you know, I would have loved to see Dali. His ego said he wanted to be the best paid person.
Right.
And so he was going to be paid by the second. So they're paying him something like $1,000 per second, but they were only going to have him in it for 5 seconds. But then they're going to have a robotic version of him to play him for the rest of the film.
That's so wild.
And it would have been so magical to have done that.
It is. And then they give it to another filmmaker who could maybe be considered surrealist, and David Lynch did it, right?
Yeah.
And it's a bit of a stinker.
it's David Lynch's big stinker. It's still
We're
a pretty
screening
cool
it,
film.
Jaden Pfeiffer's screening it at Talkies in January. Just a little
sweet
plug for that.
Oh,
in February.
Oh, we'll be there. But I do like Dune's, David Lynch's Dune, but Jodorowsky's would have been so different.
There's such a commitment to his craft, and it's a very like Gesamtkunstwerk kind of like full whole world. I was reading the Wikipedia about Holy Mountain the other day, and they were talking about these really unorthodox methods that he used, like for all of the principles in that film. He spent him and his wife spent a month not sleeping before they made the film under the guidance of a Zen master. And then everybody lived together and they studied Sufi mysticism and the Kabbalah. Like, they studied all of these like sort of esoteric religious and meditative practices. And then there's a scene where everybody, all of these initiates that are climbing the holy mountain, they're all dying and being reborn. And they're all on psilocybin mushrooms at the time.
Oh.
And I'm just like, wow, like, you really got people in on this. Like, everybody's committed to the authenticity of this process, for better or worse.
Yes, and quite often it's for the worse, but it can be for the better sometimes.
Yeah.
And there's a few films. I think the 70s were a time for experimenting this way. Can we make a film if everybody's high, you know, the whole time?
Right.
And I think there's probably a bit of a myth behind some of this. You know, mm-hmm. Somebody has to keep the image in focus.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah,
like there's
the cameraman
people
wasn't on drugs.
Yeah.
Probably.
Probably, you know, but... They won't tell you all of the story.
They'll, right. But I think like, kind of knowing some of this lore, like, sometimes it kind of gets written off as like, oh, this is a trippy film for, mm-hmm. you know, but I think it's actually much, much, much more than that.
Yes. Yes. And I think it believes in itself. Again, it's a world that once you start on this path, on this epic journey of this character, you can't follow the journey. If you get caught up trying to figure out whether the protagonist is going to succeed or not, then you're lost. You're missing the point.
Yeah.
You just have to follow that journey, maybe like a drug journey, maybe like a dream. So I guess I'm getting a little bit away from surrealism, but I've picked three films that exist in surrealist worlds, mm-hmm. that in worlds of dreams that are true to themselves and uncompromising.
Right. And they're really, maybe they are kind of, to kind of circle back to what Breton was saying, like, they're also all filmmakers who are, they believe in themselves and they believe in the work that they're creating. Like, there's a real commitment to these ideas. Does that make sense?
Yes.
It's a little...
Yes, and that's why they're respected. That's why these films are held in high regard by filmmakers. Mm. But the public quite often don't understand the films. They perhaps have taken a step too far. They've gone over a line. But it doesn't take much for the public to understand these films, enough to enjoy them.
No,
because there's great pleasure.
Yeah, they're all profoundly enjoyable films, and yeah. I think it's a really excellent selection.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's about appreciating these films, and we don't have to understand them, and we don't have to understand every metaphysical comment and metaphor within them to just enjoy the images and the craziness and the beauty and the passion and the creativity.
Well, I guess we're coming up on closing time. Thank you very much, Joe, for coming. I'm really, really looking forward to your lectures.
Thank you, Blair.
And to watching these films with you.
I'm enjoying reviewing them myself, and I'm excited about seeing them with an audience.
All right. How exciting. Thanks.
Thank you.
Take care.
RPL Film Theater would like to thank Regina Public Library. This podcast was, in part, recorded and edited at Regina Public Library Digital Media Studio. You can learn more about the DMS by visiting Central Library or reginalibrary.ca. RPL Film Theatre acknowledges that this podcast was recorded on Treaty 4 territory and thanks the diverse Indigenous peoples whose footsteps have marked and continue to mark this territory.